You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Well, good morning. My name is Li Chen. I'm a director of the John L. Sutton China Center here at Brookings. Welcome to our event on China's urbanization and the Hukou reform. It is hard to overestimate the importance of today's topic. China's urbanization process over the past three decades has been the most rapid in human history. In the early 1980s, only 20% of China's population lived in urban areas. Now, it's about 54%. Today, China is home to five of the world's 10 most populous cities. Urbanization was, is, and will continue to be what the Chinese leaders call the engine of China's robust economic growth. But as China is in the midst of transforming her economy or her economic development model from an export-led growth economy, driven by cheap labor at a huge environmental cost, to a new consumption-driven, innovation-led, and a service sector-centric model, the next phase of China's urbanization will confront multiple new challenges. PRC's Hukou system, a Chinese version of segregation that prevents migrant workers and their families from accessing social and educational services in urban areas, will go through a profound change. Hukou reform is closely intertwined with many other crucial reforms, such as financial reform, housing reform, fiscal reform, and land reform. It also raises environmental, demographical, and socio-political concerns, and has already led to heated intellectual and policy debates in the country. Today, we will hear from our distinguished panelists about what the next phase of China's urbanization will look like and how the negative implications of urbanization can be overcome. We are so honored to have two leading Chinese experts on the subject, Professor Hua Sen, Honorary Dean of the School of Economic and Management at the Southeast University, and Professor Wu Biliang, Dean of the School of Development Studies at Beijing Normal University. They will be joined by Dr. Li Guo, the World Bank's Senior Agriculture Economist in the Agriculture and the Rural Development Unit. The moderator for their panel is my esteemed colleague, David Dollar, the China Center's resident economist and a former country director for China at the World Bank. Now, I would like to mention that the Dean Wu Biliang and the Dean Hua Sen are part of the Chinese delegation led by Zhou Zixin of the Consensus Media Group, who I will introduce in a minute and who will offer his brief remarks. The delegation includes prominent PRC scholars in various fields. I would like to ask each of them to stand up and be recognized. Professor Qin Hui, would you please stand? As we know that he's a leading historian on peasants and also many other issues. And Professor Mao Zhenhua from Renmin University. Professor Xu Zhangren from Law School of Tsinghua University. Professor Jing Yan from China University of Political Science and Law. Last but not least, Professor Li Yinghe from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. By the way, Professor Li Yinghe, known as China's first sexologist, will be featured as a keynote speaker at our event on women, Sexuality and the Social Change in China tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. here in this same auditorium. You may need to arrive at 8 a.m. in order to secure a seat, you know, because who doesn't want to talk about sex first things in the morning? Finally, I would like to introduce my friend, Zhou Zixin, the head of the Chinese delegation that is with us today. Thank you. Zhou is the founder and CEO of the Consensus Media Group, whose leaders and Financial Digest magazines are among the most influential journals in China. He began his career at the Central Party Literature Research Office. Before starting his own business, Mr. Zhou also worked for Phoenix TV, where he was in charge of the website and founded the so-called Phoenix Weekly, a very important magazine published in Hong Kong but widely circulated in China, and served as its first editor-in-chief. The ConsensusNet, a digital platform focusing on China's domestic politics, history, and global affairs, has become an important venue for scholarly exchange and policy debate. This interactive online magazine has the motto, to seek consensus in the era of great change. To seek consensus through public discourse is critically important for China today, as it becomes increasingly pluralistic in so many ways. This has also become one of the biggest challenges for the Chinese leadership. I'm reminded of what the French president Charles de Gaulle once said, I quote, "How can you govern a country which has 246 varieties of cheese?" So this is the challenge that China faces today. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the man who has built such a wonderful platform in Chinese public discourse to seek consensus while respecting diversity, Mr. Zhou Zixin.
Sorry, I returned my English knowledge back to my teacher, so I need help.
非常感谢布鲁金斯学会，感谢我的朋友李成先生。当然，我也发现了我的老朋友李侃如先生坐在下面。
And thank you very much, the Brookings Institution for having me.And also, I would like to express my gratitude to my old friend Li Cheng. And also, I saw my old friend Dr. Lieber. So,
当然了，我到布鲁金斯已经来过很多次了。这是第一次站在这个讲台上。但是我第一次说话，我知道我站在这个讲台上，我是沾了我的这些同来的学者们的光。要不然的话，李成先生不可能让我站在这儿。
Well, I came to Brookings many times, but this is the first time I'm standing in the podium.And no, I was given this honor because my distinguished colleagues are here. Otherwise, Dr. Li Cheng would not have me standing here.
当然我还要说一下，我们这个代表团呢，是深圳创新发展研究院和共识网共同来主办的。这个研究院在去年的11月份在深圳的大梅沙举行了一次叫首届中国创新论坛，主题是国家治理现代化。
And also, this delegation is co-sponsored by Consensus Network and also Innovation and Development Institute based in Shenzhen. And last year in November, the Institute, Innovation and Development Institute sponsored a forum called Innovation Forum. And the theme for that forum is how to govern the country.
我们同来的毛振华先生就是这个深圳创新发展研究院的院长，他跟我讲，他说今年的秋天我们还会在那儿举行一次论坛，他也欢迎大家能够有空的话去参加这个在深圳中国创新排行第一的城市在这里举行的论坛。
And in my delegation, Mr. Mao Zhenhua is the Dean of Innovation and Development Institute. And he told me that they're going to hold another forum this year in autumn. And so I welcome everyone to come to Shenzhen to participate in this forum. And Shenzhen is ranked number one city of innovation in China.
嗯，毛总没问题吧？
来 ，OK， with you, Miss Mao。
我们这次来到美国，是延续我们以往几年到这里的一个任务，就是我们把东方和西方能够用一个桥梁更加紧密的结合起来。
Our visit to the United States this time is a continuation of our ongoing mission. That is to build a bridge between the East and the West, so our both sides will come closer.
我知道很多美国人非常关心中国，而且呢，也或多或少的知道中国存在的问题，就如同我们或多或少的知道美国存在的问题一样。
I know a lot of Americans are interested in the affairs in China, and many of you more or less know the problems in China, just like we in China, we know the United States are facing some problems as well.
所以我们的任务非常简单，就是我们和你们都共同向对方的优点学习，共同帮助对方克服自己的缺点。
So our mission is very simple, is that both sides, we and you, we learn from each other the good points,And then we help each other to overcome the problems.
我想我不再占用太多的时间，还是请下面的这些非常有水平的专家来演讲。谢谢大家。
I don't want to take too much time, so next I would like to invite our distinguished experts from our delegation to make their presentation. Thank you.
If you mic me first, I can start talking. Good morning. I'm David Dollar from the Thornton Center here at Brookings. Very happy to moderate this session. This is a fantastic topic. As my colleague Lee Chung said, in some ways, China's urbanization is the fastest we've ever seen in history.The urban population went from about 200 million people at the beginning of economic reform to 700 million people 30 years later. But in another sense, urbanization has actually been slow in China. You know, as Li Cheng said, the urban population, including migrants now, is 54% of the population. And that's actually quite low for China's stage of development. When South Korea was at this stage, it already was 70 to 80% urban.So we can anticipate that probably another 200 or 300 million people will become urban in China over the next 10 to 20 years. And we all know about the hukou system and makes sense that if there's a system restricting movement, that's probably one of the reasons why the urbanization rate is somewhat low in China. So a lot of talk now about reforming hukou. To me, the key topics here are hukou reform, more generally the process of urbanization,And then that ties to the whole issue of land use. So very happy to have this outstanding panel. From China, we have Hu Biliang, professor and dean of the School of Development Studies at Beijing Normal University. Their bios are on the material, so I'm not going to waste time with a long introduction. Hua Sheng, honorary dean of the School of Economics and Management at Southeast University. And then my former colleague from the World Bank. I'm former. He's still at the World Bank. Li Guo, senior agricultural economist and someone with long experience working on land and agricultural issues in China. So I've asked them each to start with about 7 minutes of remarks on this topic. And after that, I'll take a few minutes to ask them some questions, but then we'll open up and make sure there's plenty of time for interaction with the audience. So we'll go in the order we've got here, which is Hu Biliang first.
Okay, thank you very much, David. I'm very, very happy today to, you know, to be here by chance and to meet some good friends, older friends, like David Dollar. He used to be the country director, the bureau chief, and also chief economist of World Bank in Beijing. And also my boss, Peter Bodnia, I saw him. when I was working with the World Bank Beijing office, he was exactly my boss and also my advisor. He was the chief representative of World Bank in Beijing at that time in the early 1990s. Very happy to see you. And also Nigo, used to be, we met each other, you know, 30 years ago. So good friends, and I was very happy to meet some old new friends, like Li Chen. I read very intensify his writings from time to time, from many years ago. I'm very, very happy. So today I feel the happiest people, the man in the world. I'm very, thank you very much for organizers to you know, having me here. So just David mentioned that, and also he you know, asked me to give some comments about Hukou system reform. Was because I had a speech in the National Committee of United States China relations in New York. You know, I had a whole talk about the new urbanization and the impacts to the future development in China. So I don't want to repeat what I taught in New York. You may read some of the news about that. I'm going to focus on Hukou system reform. I tried to give you 3 points for your comments and reference. Number one, my general judgment about Hukou system reform. Generally speaking, the situation getting much better. You know, if so that means the Hukou has been what we call the family household registration system has been relaxed a lot now than before. But we need to also, you know, at the same time to see, you know, changes among different cities, different type of cities. It's quite different. If you look at the government intended only to, you know, relax control of the Hukou, for the people moving into the small cities, maximum maybe the medium-sized cities, but not for the big cities, particularly for the cities like Beijing. I think the control even more, you know, severe. Now than before, more restrictive control, like, you know, for the big cities like Beijing, for example. As you know that, over the past many years, the net, you know, immigrants into Beijing, was about, you know, normally more than 1 million for many years. But gradually, you know, reduced to about, 0.8 million. But now it's, less than half a million. So the control for the big cities, you know, is, more severe than before. But for the, you know, for the small cities and small towns or medium cities, the government encourages people, you know, move into this type of small cities, but they don't have any interest in moving, right? Because, you know, lack of social services, the public provision is not comparable with the, you know, big cities, and also, you know, lack of, you know, opportunities in the, these kind of cities. So they want to stay there. So, but the government encouraging them to go there. So there's contradiction always between the government, what the government thinking, and what the people thinking, you know? So that's a general situation. So the second point, what's the main problem now? There are two problems. The first problem is, I think, usually two ignorance. The first ignorance is the government neglected the importance of the market role in the process of urbanization. So the government always, you know, think urbanization is a government planned process, is a government designed process, you know, is not a market process. So this is the old mentality for years, but the situation has been still going on. Even, you know, look at the new plan which issued last year, the state new urbanization planning, 2014 to 2020. It's the old mentality. The government plan, we're going to do this, to do that. But, you know, maybe the people don't think like this way. So they ignore the importance of market into the process of urbanization. This is the one ignorance. The other ignorance, the government ignored to improve the social services, social, you know, public goods provision into the Indian medium-sized cities, small towns. At the same time, you know, the government encourages people to stay in there without, you know, better services, without improvement of the services to the people living in the small cities, right? So that was a contradiction with, you know, the people and the government. So these are two ignorances. And then my suggestions focus on two improvements, you know, by linking with the ignorances. The first improvement is the government need to improve the macro environment for the market to play more important role in the process of new urbanization. So this new round of urbanization, based on the market regulations, based on the market rules, right? So I think this is very critical. They always think what the government, you know, should do, but they don't think about the people, don't think about the market, you know. Okay. So the government or people need to follow the logic. When you think about urbanization, actually it's kind of a market force driven. The factor flow into certain places were concentrated or expanded. That's dependent on the government, on market, but not dependent by the government. So the government need to improve the environment to allow the market to play more importance in process of urbanization. This is one improvement. The second improvement was by Nichols in Lawrence, is the government need to improve the public goods provision and public service provision in the small and the medium-sized cities. So people have, you know, make the small towns and small cities, medium-sized cities, to more attractive to the people. So you don't need to force the people, you know, to do this or to that, right? So the people, they can make decisions by themselves because they're all regional people, right? So these so 3 points I would like to share with you for your comments and reference. I would like to stop here.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Very interesting and exactly on time. So thank you very much. All right. Huasheng?
Yeah. Morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very honored to give a speech here. And yeah, coming here reminds me that it has been 24 years since I came to U.S. last time. So I noticed no familiar face here. Last time we invited by the State Department to discuss what happened in China in 1980s. Yeah. And I'm an economist focused on the mechanism design. In 1980s, and with my colleague, we put forward a dual track pricing system, which was accepted by the central government and influenced the Chinese economic reform process throughout. And number two is about the state asset management system. It works not so well, and I haven't got time to help them to sort it out. The third one is topic today, the urbanization. And actually in China, you can notice it's called new urbanization. This was put forward by me 10 years ago. You may remember 10 years ago in 2005, Chinese Communist Party issued a document and going to launch a movement called New Rural Development or New Rural Construction. I wrote a letter to General Secretary and the Premier at that time, who and when. I said, this is not a good idea because the New Rural Development was an old concept and under Chairman Mao. And now the world has changed. Now we China need industrialization and urbanization to modernize China. So what is important is not the new rural development. Yeah, it is good and important, but not so important for the whole nation. So I said the new urbanization maybe should be focus of the government. And actually, the new urbanization including a few concepts. One is about hukou reform, that is household registration reform. Second one is concerned with the land reform. The third one is concerned with the financial reform, especially how to finance in the government budget. The three things are combined together. But it's not until the new leaders come to office, the idea began to accept. So now, the thing is how to sort out the problem with a combined plan. I have heard people not quite as clear in terms of international comparable standard. China's urbanization rate is well below the comparable economy at this stage. And so in this sense, I'm afraid I'm a little bit different from Li Chen. China's urbanization process is not the rapidest. It is biggest in terms of the human shift in world history, but not the rapidest. Because South Korea, Taiwan, and Japan spend less time to reach 55% of urbanization. So that's actually the main problem or the main imbalance in China today. A few years ago, I think when I put forward a suggestion, at that time, many people, both in academic circle, also in government, believe that China's system, what I mean is the farmers has the double status, both they work in the city and also they have land in their village. It's a very good model. It's a special characteristic of Chinese economy. That's why make China become most competitive in the world. And also, that's why China has the freest labor market, it seems to me, in the world. And that's the key reason for China become the so-called world factory. So, not until the second generation of agricultural worker, a migrant worker, growing up, there is a shift in the government, also in academic circle. That is, the people realize we have to seriously deal with the migrant workers' problem. Yeah, because the second generation of migrant workers, they have no skill or knowledge about the agriculture. And they have no intention return to their hometown. So it will become a big trouble for the government and for the social stability. I think this is one of very important reasons why the government will listen to the idea, the new urbanization. That means it may need to sort out the problems. Yeah. Also, the hukou system is not something new or invented by the Chinese Communist Party. It's a long history in China. Yeah. It was very popular in the period of Warring States, a few hundred years BC. Yeah. And as an instrument serves for tax and conscription purpose. And so after the Chinese Communist Party took power, there is no migration control at all. But the internal logic of planning economy demands to control the human resources. So that's why it was set up in 1958. And the hukou system actually was greatly relaxed in 1984 because that's the first time Chinese government allowed the the rural residents to find a job in the city. Okay. And to so long as they can feed themselves. So you can see the main concern for the Chinese government always the supply of the food. Okay. So with the family farming in China called household responsibility system, then we have plenty supply of agricultural food and also surplus of labor. Yeah. At that time, I was a farmer in the countryside for many years during Cultural Revolution. So since then, since began to change. But the thing is, agricultural worker, they have no urban status or have no urban hukou. So they're in an underclass position. There's no housing and no social benefit and so on and so forth. So now the thing is how to deal with this. The government actually has pushed forward the hukou reform. And officially, we began to take two approaches. And number one is to separate the social benefits with the hukou. Because without social benefit, hukou meaningless. It's meaningless, okay? So the idea is very good, and the government leader is very, very, very easy to accept it because it's comply to the Chinese economic reform as a gradualist way. Okay? So that's one approach. Another approach is to set up a marking system. Yeah, if you accumulate certain points, you can directly get the urban, local urban hukou. So the two approach looks very good on paper. But the trouble is that now what the Chinese government are facing with is the real problem. For the number one, to separate the social benefits from hukou. Problem is, for the pension and the medical care, it's already separate from the hukou. It's combined with the employment. Yeah, if you are employed, you have to pay the pension contribution and things like this. And you can get all the pension and medical care better than US in China. But the thing is, because the agricultural worker, they stay in one place in a very short time. They move very quickly. So they don't care about their benefit in remote future. For the employee, for the employer, it's good just to pay a little bit more salary without social benefit. So as a matter of fact, majority of the migrant worker have no social benefits. It's not the law or the regulation prevent this, but it's economic logic. Yeah. Becomes a reality. So that's number one. Number two, about the directly the marking system. Okay. For the point is for the big cities that set up a very high standard. It's very difficult to accumulate points. Yeah, it's easy for people like overseas scholars like us, but it's extremely difficult for the agricultural worker. So because every hukou account for a big sum of money. There is an estimate, even in small to middle-sized cities, it needs something like around $20,000 to give one hukou. Okay? And in a big city, much more. So the local government has no incentive to do this. And the point is, the land, they get land from the farmers and sell it in the housing market. That is the main financial resources for Chinese local government to finance infrastructure, the city, of the city. So the main thing is to provide low-cost housing to the migrant workers. That's the key of the hukou reform, land reform, financial reform. But just in this place, that's a fringe part of the Chinese government. Yeah, the local government is busy. Yeah, that's like their main financial resources. They can, if they provide the low cost housing, they even become more difficult because even at the moment they are in big trouble of the high debt. And for the central government, they pay more attention to the so-called shantytown renovation. Yeah, that is the deplorable area within the city. Yeah, it's good, but it's not for the agricultural worker. Okay, I'll finish here. So I think the main challenge to the Chinese economic growth lies here. Deduct the migrant workers and their families. Of course, most of their family member is in the hometown. So we have more than 60 million children left behind in their village. That's something that's really shocking. But how to deal with this? Yeah, the money and land reform and hukou reform is combined together. And China deduct the agricultural work. The urbanization rate actually stands for 36% of the whole population. It's very low level. Yeah, it's an underdeveloped country. Yeah, it's a very backward country level. So the China's economy at this stage cannot support the economic growth with so low urbanization rate. So that's the key of it. Okay, I will stop here. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, Dean Hua. I expected to learn a lot this morning. I already learned that the registration system goes back to the Warring States period. So I find that fascinating. I wonder if Confucius wrote anything about the hukou system. So I'll ask them that later. Li Guo.
Okay, thank you very much, David. And first, I'm very happy to be here to meet some old friends and also have an opportunity to make some new friends. And I really appreciate this opportunity to exchange the views on rural on urbanization as well as hukou reform. I'm an agriculture economist, and I work on rural development, poverty reduction, land policy dialogue, and agriculture smallholder development in China and East Asia countries as well as some African countries. So I think you will not be surprised I will approach this issue from rural development perspective. Because eventually, the core issue is how to, urbanization is how to deal with, how to treat these 300 million, 400 million, farm workers, migrant workers. And also, I think it's very important to keep that in mind. When we talk about urbanization, we should also ask the question, what's the impact on China's agriculture and rural development? Because there is a question whether the current status, current level of rural development and agriculture can support further urbanization or not. What's the implication? So I think maybe useful to have a little bit of background. What we saw today in terms of urbanization, hukou, large scale of migrant workers actually is result of quite a successful story in terms of rural development, in terms of overall economic development. So in the past 35 years, started with in late 1970s or early 1980s, China dismantled people's commune, introduced household responsibility system, increased agricultural productivity, then create very vibrant, dynamic township village enterprises sector, and then follow up very, healthy, very fast overall economic growth and social transformation. So then we reach this current status, current, situation, and we're facing urbanization, large scale of the migrant workers. So by pointing out this background, I just want to draw a very important difference between China and many other developing countries. Because I work on Africa countries, southern part of Africa, I saw they have a very high urbanization degree, like South Africa, 65 or 70. But that kind of high degree urbanization actually is a result of a serious underdevelopment of a rural sector. So basically, we observe the situation in some countries, they just migrate rural poor to urban poor. And we all know, actually, urban poverty is much more difficult to deal with. I think China's situation is a little bit different. So in terms of China's urbanization, I think previous two panelists already, point out, starting from early 1980s, we have only 18 or 20%. And then last year, I just checked before I walk into this auditorium, I checked the website. The Statistics Bureau says by 2014, the urbanization degree is 54.77. So Hua Sheng also made a very good point. That's by where you live, live more than 6 months, then you count as an urban population. But if you actually look at hukou, by hukou category, actually the real urbanization degree is only about 38 or 37. So there is about 18 percentage points difference. So this 18% teach points actually represent 250 million people. So now we have a 750 by that definition, by where you live, 750 million urban population, but by hukou actually is only, you have to deduct 250 million from there. Then by 2030, we expect there are another 150 million people will move to urban area, basically each every year about 1%, maybe a little bit higher, accelerating rate. But the big picture is like that. So that's so what's the challenge? So I think first the government fully appreciates, you know, the importance of urbanization and also understand how important to treat, you know, migrant worker and existing urban residents equally. For example, you know, if you read NDRC, National Development and Reform Commission's new urbanization plan issued early last year, actually they give a very high status in terms of importance, attach great importance of this issue. They say that's an opportunity for China, you know, the engine for, like Li Chun mentioned, is the engine for next round economic growth, and opportunity to upgrading China's economic growth model, and also opportunity to promote, you know, more balanced regional development, as well as opportunity to, golden opportunity to, you know, modernize China's agriculture sector. So in terms of a challenge, you know, again, from agricultural rural development perspective, I think the very first one, we should never underestimate. I know maybe you compare with Japan, South Korea, you know, slow, you know, in terms of from 30% percentage to 50% or 55%, where we are slower than Japan. But we have to take into account China's, you know, large scale population size. So I think that will be a long process, maybe take another 20 or 30 years. Some, you know, in People's Congress in March, some very senior government official says it may take 3 to 4 generations based on what they observed before 1949, before Communist Party took power. You know, one farmer household moved to Shanghai. After they actually settled down and behaved like urban residents, it took them 3 or 4 generations. So, you know, the first challenge is a long process. Second challenge, I think, is very complicated. We should never underestimate the complexity, because this involves not only hukou. Hukou is a piece of paper, but actually has implication on land management, public finance, housing, education, medical services, and urban administration. So that's a mixture of so many challenging area government has to move, meaningful reform to achieve that goal. So this is a process, I think, full of a negotiation and compromise and between different interest group, between local government and central government. Government, of course, central government can play a very important role, but this is a negotiation process and a compromise process. As we all know, you know, now it's about 14 or 15 provinces. They publicly abolished two type hukous. Everyone, you know, just treat as the same. But in reality, they didn't treat them. They didn't enjoy the same benefits. So, as again, that's not just a piece of paper. A piece of paper issue. Now, also, I think another challenge is 80% of the urbanized people, actually, their employment come from private sector. So I think we definitely need to have a very enabling environment to foster the rural the private sector development. Another one I think is very important, many people ignore that, is how to treat farmers' land rights during the process. As we all know, in Chengdu, in Chongqing, some areas, you know, the pilot area, they ask farmers to give up their land rights, give up in exchange for public service, in exchange for, you know, I think that's not right, definitely. That's against the law. You shouldn't give up your property rights in exchange for some government services. So I think one indicator to evaluate the success of the urbanization as well as hukou reform is how you treat farmers' land rights. Another one, the final one is the impact on agriculture, because as we all know, the 250 million, 400 million people move into cities, their income increases, their consumption structure changed, and has a huge implication on agriculture outputs, whether China's agriculture sector can match the challenge or demands. That's a question. So we have to keep that in mind. Let me stop here. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. Very interesting. So let me start the conversation by asking each of them a question in turn, and then we'll have plenty of time to turn to the audience. So let me start with Hubi Liang. So I took from your comments that you're in favor of kind of a more market-oriented approach. So in some ways, it kind of anticipates the question I wanted to ask you, but I'm going to go ahead and ask you anyway because I want to press a little bit into this. It seems to me this idea of encouraging people to move to third and fourth tier cities is actually quite risky. You know, the big productivity gains come from people moving to the most productive cities, and presumably a kind of more market-oriented approach would lead to that. And given China's demographics, the workforce is actually going to start declining in cities like Beijing and Shanghai unless there's a steady stream of migrants, you know, coming from the countryside. So I would think over time, you know, the incentives might change. But my question for you really is, are people responding to this new openness in third and fourth tier cities? It's early days, but are people actually moving to third and fourth tier cities? Those happen to be cities where we also know there are lots of empty apartments. So potentially this could be an attractive policy. People move into cities where there's a lot of housing available. Presumably housing prices are going down. What I worry about, the real question I want to ask is, what are those people going to do for work? You know, that's what I worry about is, what are the employment opportunities in third and fourth tier cities? You know, there's been some talk about, you know, some of the manufacturing base kind of moving westward and into third and fourth tier cities. I'm very skeptical that the government can direct manufacturing investment into places like this. So I worry there's a risk that people might start moving, and in fact, there's really no employment for these people, you know, and or they in fact don't respond. So it's more free to move to third and fourth tier cities, but perhaps nobody's actually doing that. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about that.
Okay, I think the migration is a very selective process. You know, some people moving into different places, not determined by the government, even sometimes not determined by themselves. I like to stay in Washington, D.C., I like to stay in New York, right? If I cannot find a job, if I'm not capable to find a job, you know, I'm not capable to pay the cost of living, I cannot be there. So this is why the open society, like open city system without a who-go, this kind of system, if in U.S. works very well, right? That's purely depends, number one, depends on the market regulations. The market determines where you, the selection by yourself. As I mentioned, you are the man, make decisions based on the market rules. So, this is why I focus very much on the market forces in the process of the selection of migration. The other point I also mentioned that is the government function to providing better services. So when you get balance, so this is equilibrium between the government action and the market action. So, but we pay very much attention to the overdone by the government over the past years. But we neglected the importance of the market. So from now on, we need to do that, their job. And the other factor, if you think about the China situation, is because why people have a very strong motivation to move from rural area to the urban areas, as Huasen just mentioned, that because the government, you know, discriminated long-time urban bias policies. They put much, much, you know, energy or investment into cities for the urban residents without any reasons. But they discriminated it, on the other hand, to the farmers, you know, who contributed not to the, you know, primary accumulation of industrialization, urbanization, initial stage of the founding of New China. Right? So this is the policy, a lot of fear for part of people. So this is the dual system working in China. It's very, very unfair. One country, two systems. So this is what the people say, right? The two worlds, one country, two worlds. So these two things, we need to think about that. If we can work where think about the urbanization hookah system from these two ways. So I think the situation will be gradually getting improved.
Yeah. Okay. It naturally leads to the question I want to ask you. If you want to comment on this, but the question I was going to ask you is very closely related. Mm-hmm. Huasheng, yeah. You mentioned that remarkable statistic, which I've seen before, that there's 60 million left behind children in China. So children where both parents have moved to cities, they're typically living with grandparents and going to rural schools. And despite the big effort to improve rural schools, they are much lower quality than urban schools. Now, what I worry about, so first there's an ethical and equity issue. But aside from that, there's a practical economic issue. As I said, the urban population workforce is going to decline in China because of the demographics unless you have continuing rural urban migration. So a lot of the new workforce in the cities will in fact be those 60 million children. You know, many of those 60 million children who are studying in the countryside are going to move to cities. So the question is, as China moves up the value chain in manufacturing and it becomes more of a service economy, it needs various skills and college educated, you know, is potentially this could really become a macroeconomic constraint for China. You know, from the point of view of the country as a whole, I think it's in your interest to invest in those children. And the easiest way to do that, in fact, is to educate them in the cities. It's easier to provide quality education in the cities. But you yourself pointed out that local governments have no incentive, right? An individual local government has no incentive to take in a lot of these people and spend the money on educating them. As you develop a freer labor market, you know, a lot of that benefit could easily diffuse because you study in one place and then you move somewhere else to work. So it's kind of a classic externality problem from the point of view of the local government. You also briefly mentioned the issue of what you call financial, which I think mostly you were thinking about fiscal issues. So the question I want to ask you is, there have been some good ideas about fiscal reform in China and changing the incentives for local government, right? So it seems very much in China's interest to have fiscal reform to make sure local governments have the resources to educate all the people there and provide health services, et cetera. It wouldn't be that hard to do the fiscal reform. There's talk of changing the incentive for local government. You know, do you see that these changes are actually going to come about? Can you give us some sense of progress and whether this will address some of these problems?
I don't know whether I can answer you this question because I spent 4 years write two books to analyze the things like this. And it seems to me most important is to set up a mechanism which can work in the Chinese context. So that's what I'm doing during the past 30 years. So I think, all things related. How to finance the migrant worker and their families, okay? The point is, they have the money have come from the land, Because urbanization, the land around the city value increased sharply. Okay. And now the increasing of land value in the cities captured by the land developers, okay, and also the government, local government, but the local government uses money to finance the city development, okay. And so the main problem is all these migrant family, they have land, but in a remote area, in their villages, it worth very little, even in a free market, just like in U.S. Yeah, the remote area agricultural land, it worth very little, but all the land in the city or around the city, the value will increase tremendously. So I look carefully into the experience of Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. I think they offer a valuable lesson for us. Yeah, that's why only the East Asia region become a developed economy. I think the secret is here. We should pay attention to here. We should to study their example. Yeah, For all these three areas, there is no slam, large scale slam, that transform majority of the population into the citizen within less than 50 years. So I think what China should learn from them, although China is a huge country and it's not comparable, but in terms of farmable land, China is very similar to Japan and South Korea, or Taiwan. Okay. So the population as a whole is not a problem. The thing is a percentage, you see. So I can't give you answer here. And yeah, I think we that's the key point I should to stress. And I have to, also I want to draw your attention to is because the big scale of China, there is a real problem that is in many developing countries or developed countries, there are large percentage of population concentrated in the capital or in the business center. Okay? In East Europe, let's say, 20%, even 30% is not something surprising. But for China, even 10% of population concentrated, let's imagine, in Shanghai or in Beijing, that's more than 100 million people. Okay, that's a human and ecological disaster. So I think the Chinese leaders worry this. Yeah, it's worth consideration. But the current reform on the, they have the land reform, experimental reform, is going to carry on for next 3 years. It's very bad. It's very bad direction. Yeah, I think it will need to fruit this. Yeah. So now the thing is how to set up mechanism which can motivate all the people in the local government, the central government, and also in business circle, can transform the migrant workers and their families become the open citizen, and with proper funding, and come from the land, the value of land increase. Yeah, so that's a mechanism. Yeah, according to my experience during the past 30 years, most important thing is you set up a mechanism. Yeah, combine all the people's interests, it can work. Like dual track pricing system. Yeah, it sounds in the first place it sounds it's something ugly, but it works very well. Yeah, so same is true for the anti-corruption campaign. So our new job is to set up a mechanism. How can it work to control corruption in a country like China, emerging economy with authoritarian state? So, okay, I'll stop here.
Thank you very much. Li Guo, you mentioned the issue of farmers' property rights over land. So I read recently that the average density of Chinese cities has actually gone down. You know, so we've emphasized this tremendous increase in population, but the percentage increase in land has actually been greater. It's really quite remarkable, right? And I think it's related to the incentive that local government has to dispossess people on the outskirts of the city, pay below market compensation. It's a way to accelerate development. It can also be a source of corruption. Right. So I guess my question for you, because I know you've studied the land issues, is this what's essentially a property rights issue? You know, is this changing? Is this improving? Is there hope to reduce this land intensity of China's urbanization and have a kind of more typical pattern where, you know, more typical patterns, people actually move into the existing urban space, whereas in China, a lot of additional urban space has been created on the outskirts of cities.
Yes, I think in terms of first, you know, the population density or land intensity, I agree with you know, the judgment. Actually, if we look at what happened in, for example, South Korea, capital city, so if Guangzhou reaches the population density as a South Korea capital city, then Guangzhou can attract additional 4.1 million. I read one report. I think that's from my perspective, that's convincing. So it's very important to, how to say, to let the agglomeration effects of the big city come out and benefit, you know, the wider, you know, population and promote additional economic development. That's one point. Second one, in terms of land reform, yes, I think I'm optimistic, you know, by my understanding about the policy direction. Maybe speed of reform is appears very slow. For example, they say, you know, in past 5 years, they always say, you know, we will reform the land acquisition. But actually, the land acquisition has never been meaningfully reformed. And also now they start to say, oh, let's let, you know, rural construction land enter the market directly instead of going through national government acquisition. So, and the reason why I'm optimistic because now they start to pilot this in 33 counties and in different areas. So I hope the pilot will be national representative and they plan to conclude the pilot by 2017. So then they will draw the lessons into the policy formulation and decision-making process. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Now we can turn to questions from the audience. Please introduce yourself. I think what I'll do is I'll take three before I go back to the panel. I'd like to avoid all three panelists answering every single question because then we don't get enough done. So we'll start here. Okay, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Lee Yang. About urbanization, I think there are several, and I will try to limit three, related issues. First, is whether they want to develop based on a public-private partnership, which very often, whether in the United States or in Africa, they usually is misused and abused. And second, related to just the monetary of government policies, how do they really treat the rural area, the land ownership? How do they really take away their land values? They maybe say your land originally is somewhat 100% market value, but then they reduce to, they say, about 50% by some manipulations. And the third one is about hukou registration. The way you do this, whether there's an intrusion of private privacy or they have some kind of threat or some kind of the way they want to enforce their policies, or they will take the opponents prisoners, political prisoners. So how do you deal with that issues?
Okay. I'll keep track. And the gentleman back there.
Yeah, Bill Jones from Executive Intelligence Review. In connection with the new normal, the Chinese government, of course, has issued the One Belt, One Road policy, which will be the focal point, one of the developing points of the economy. I'm wondering, as this thing grows, it seems to me that the second and third tier cities will become more important because they will be placed on a main corridor of economic development between Europe and Asia. And I was wondering, how do you see that affecting the urbanization process as a whole? It seems to me that there will be an acceleration and will provide more opportunities, but I'd like your opinion on that.
Okay, good question. And I'm going to call my colleague Ken Liebertal, but there would be plenty of time to get it to everybody who's got their hands up.
Thank you. Very, very interesting panel. I have three questions, if I can, but they're generally very short answers required. One, when you talk about the plans for urbanization in the next 5 to 10 years, how much the urban population will grow, a little bit of a definitional question. As current migrants in the cities who still have rural hukou obtain urban hukou, does that count as urbanization? In other words, do they count as the increase in urban residents, or is it only people literally moving into the cities that are envisioned when you talk about the additional number, you know, the additional rate of urbanization? So that's number one. In other words, there's a definition. Are you talking about ongoing immigration, or are you also counting simply the change in hukou of people already there? Secondly, a lot of current urban migrants have parents and kids in the countryside. To what extent is the next stage of urbanization envisaging not only bringing the kids into the cities, but bringing the parents into the cities? So as completion of families, that will have a lot of repercussions for the requirements for provision of public goods and also for employment and productivity. And then finally, the discussion has really been in terms of migration to second and third tier cities versus to the largest cities. But China faces enormous differences in the capacity to sustain urban growth in terms of things like available usable water supplies. And I haven't seen it. I haven't seen urbanization plans differentiated in terms of the resource base, especially for water. And so my question is that being factored in? And if so, how does that affect the comments that you've made? Thank you.
Ken, can you give the mic to the gentleman next to you, and you'll start the next round if you just hold the mic, okay? So if you just – I'm trying to be efficient. So okay. What we're going to do is we're going to go down this way, and then the next round we'll come back. Okay. You know, okay? So you pick out what
you
want.
Pick up the questions and one. Okay,
and I'll take anything left over I have to answer,
thank
okay?
You. Thank you. I point just to pick one of the questions. You ask you three questions. One question regarding to PPP, private-public partnership. So mechanism in the process of urbanization, we ignored it in this kind of a mechanism before because all the infrastructures building by the government finance. So, and also the whole urbanization pushing forward, based on the finance from the government before. This is the old model, but now Premier Li Keqiang very clearly, especially the Vice Minister Liu Jiwei, last year mentioned very clearly we need to use the PPP model mechanism to promote urbanization from now on, the second round urbanization, which is what called the new urbanization, right? So that means more and more investment opportunities in the cities, like infrastructure facilities, subways, transportation system can be done by the private people, your private investors, usually done by the government companies, right? So now I think this is a good sign. Now already started from last year. So this is a lot of problem from now on. Your question, one belt, one road, So I think that would be very, very good, very positive for developing the western part of China, particularly, five underdeveloped provinces, Shaanxi, Gansu, Ningxia, Xinjiang, and Qinghai, right? So along with the increase, I think a significant increase of transportation capacity and the people's, the flow of our commodities, merchants, and also flow of people among different countries in the western part of China by linking with China and Europe. So that would be very, very positive to your support the overall development of the whole western part of China. We spent, as you know, that we spent almost 20 years, 15 years to develop the western part of China. But, not efficient, if results come out so far. I think this round of the strategy, as you mentioned, that one belt, one road policy will be absolutely, to increase will be positive for the development of this region. And the final question is, Mr. Nika, by the way, I read your book, Governing China. Thank you very much. The question you just mentioned that, what's the question?
Maybe we should,
I'm
guessing Huasheng and there's some good questions for Li Guo,
Okay. I directly go to his question about whether to change the registration of rural hukou to urban hukou is mean something, subsistence. I think answer is affirmative. Yeah, why the local government don't want to give a local urban hukou to the migrant workers? The migrant workers including not only the people from countryside, but also from the other small towns or cities, you see. And the reason is if you give them the urban hukou, you obliged to provide all these benefits, including the most important thing is low cost housing.
The other point I also mentioned that is the government function to providing better services. So we need to get balance. So this is equilibrium between the government action and the market action. So, but we pay very much attention to the overdone by the government over the past years, but we neglected the importance of the market. So from now on, we need to do that, the job. And the other factor, if you think about the China situation, is because why people so are very, have a very strong motivation to move from rural area to urban areas, as Huasen just mentioned, that because the government, discriminated long-time urban bias policies. They put much, energy or investment into cities for the urban residents without any reasons. But they discriminated it, on the other hand, to the farmers, who contributed not to the, primary accumulation of industrialization, urbanization, initial stage of the funding of New China. Right? So this is the policy, a lot of fear for part of people. So this is the dual system working in China. It's very, very unfair. One country, two systems. So this is what the people said, right? The two worlds, one country, two worlds. So these two things, we need to think about that. If we can work aware, think about urbanization, hukou system from these two ways. So I think the situation will be gradually getting improved.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it naturally leads to the question I want to ask you. If you want to comment on this, but the question I was going to ask you is very closely related. Mm-hmm. Huasheng, yeah. You mentioned that remarkable statistic, which I've seen before, that there's 60 million left behind children in China. So children where both parents have moved to cities, that are typically living with grandparents and going to rural schools. And despite the big effort to improve rural schools, they are much lower quality than urban schools. Now, what I worry about, so first there's an ethical and equity issue. But aside from that, there's a practical economic issue. As I said, the urban population workforce is going to decline in China because of the demographics unless you have continuing rural urban migration. So a lot of the new workforce in the cities will in fact be those 60 million children. Many of those 60 million children who are studying in the countryside are going to move to cities. So the question is, as China moves up the value chain in manufacturing and it becomes more of a service economy, it needs various skills and college educated, is potentially this could really become a macroeconomic constraint for China. From the point of view of the country as a whole, I think it's in your interest to invest in those children. And the easiest way to do that, in fact, is to educate them in the cities. It's easier to provide quality education in the cities. But you yourself pointed out that local governments have no incentive, right? An individual local government has no incentive to take in a lot of these people and spend the money on educating them. As you develop a freer labor market, a lot of that benefit could easily diffuse because you study in one place and then you move somewhere else to work. So it's kind of a classic externality problem from the point of view of the local government. You also briefly mentioned the issue of what you call financial, which I think mostly you were thinking about fiscal issues. So the question I want to ask you is, there have been some good ideas about fiscal reform in China and changing the incentives for local government, right? So it seems very much in China's interest to have fiscal reform to make sure local governments have the resources to educate all the people there and provide health services, et cetera. It wouldn't be that hard to do the fiscal reform. There's talk of changing the incentive for local government. Do you see that these changes are actually going to come about? Can you give us some sense of progress and whether this will address some of these problems?
I don't know whether I can answer you this question because I spent 4 years write two books to analyze the things like this. And it seems to me most important is to set up a mechanism which can work in the Chinese context. So that's what I'm doing during the past 30 years. So I think, all things related. How to finance the migrant worker and their families, okay? The point is, they have the money have come from the land. Yeah. Because urbanization, the land around the city value increased sharply. Okay. And now the increasing of land value in the cities captured by the land developers, okay, and also the government, local government, but the local government uses money to finance the city development, okay. And so the main problem is all these migrant family, they have land, but in a remote area, in their villages, it was very little, even in a free market, just like in U.S. Yeah, the remote area agricultural land, it was very little. But all the land in the city or surround the city, the value increased tremendously. So I look carefully into the experience of Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. I think they offer a valuable lesson for us. Yeah, that's why only the East Asia region become a developed economy. I think the secret is here. We should pay attention to here. We should to study their example. Yeah, there has, for all these three areas, there is no slum, large scale slum. They transform majority of the population into the citizen within less than 50 years. So I think what China should learn from them, although China is a huge country and it's not comparable, but in terms of farmer land, China is very similar to Japan and South Korea or Taiwan. Okay. So the population as a whole is not a problem. The thing is a percentage, you see. So I can't give you answer here, and I think we that's the key point. I should to stress, and I have to also I want to draw your attention to is because the big scale of China, there is a real problem that is in many developing countries or developed countries, there are large percentage of population concentrate in the capital or in the business center. Okay? In East Europe, let's say 20%, even 30% is not something surprising. But for China, even 10% of population concentrated, let's imagine in Shanghai or in Beijing, that's more than 100 million people. Okay, that's a human and ecological disaster. So I think the Chinese leaders worry this. Yeah, it's worth consideration. But the current reform on they have the land reform, experimental reform, is going to carry on for next 3 years. It's very bad. It's very, very bad direction. Yeah, I think it will need to fruitless. Yeah. So now the thing is how to set up mechanism which can motivate all the people in the local government, the central government, and also in business circle, can transform the migrant workers and their families become the urban citizen, and with proper funding, and come from the land, the value of land increase. Yeah, so that's a mechanism. Yeah, according to my experience during the past 30 years, most important is you set up a mechanism. Yeah, combine all the people's interests, it can work. Like dual track pricing system. Yeah, it sounds in the first place, it's something ugly, but it works very well. Yeah. So same is true for the anti-corruption campaign. So our new job is to set up a mechanism. How can it work to control corruption in a country like China, emerging economy with authoritarian state? So, okay, I'll stop here.
Thank you very much. Li Guo, you mentioned the issue of farmers' property rights over land. So I read recently that the average density of Chinese cities has actually gone down. You know, so we've emphasized this tremendous increase in population, but the percentage increase in land has actually been greater. It's really quite remarkable, right? And I think it's related to the incentive that local government has to dispossess people on the outskirts of the city, pay below market compensation. It's a way to accelerate development. It can also be a source of corruption, right? So I guess my question for you, because I know you've studied the land issues, is this what's essentially a property rights issue? You know, is this changing? Is this improving? Is there hope to reduce this land intensity of China's urbanization and have a kind of more typical pattern where, you know, more typical patterns, people actually move into the existing urban space, whereas in China, a lot of additional urban space has been created on the outskirts of cities.
Yes, I think in terms of, first, you know, the population density or land intensity, I agree with, you know, the judgment. Actually, if we look at what happened in, for example, South Korea, a capital city, Seoul, if Guangzhou reaches the population density as a South Korea capital city, then Guangzhou can attract additional 4.1 million. I read one report. I think that's, from my perspective, that's convincing. So it's very important to let the agglomeration effects of the big city come out and benefit, you know, the wider, you know, population and promote additional economic development. That's one point. Second one, in terms of land reform, yes, I think I'm optimistic, you know, by my understanding about the policy direction. Maybe speed of reform appears very slow. For example, they say, you know, in past 5 years, they always say, you know, we will reform the land acquisition. But actually, the land acquisition has never been meaningfully reformed. And also now they start to say, oh, let's let, you know, rural construction land enter the market directly instead of going through national government acquisition. So, and the reason why I'm optimistic because now they start to pilot this in 33 counties and in different areas. So I hope the pilot will be national representative and will, and they plan to conclude the pilot by 2017. So then they will draw the lessons into the policy formulation and decision-making process. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now we can turn to questions from the audience. Please introduce yourself. I think what I'll do is I'll take three before I go back to the panel. I'd like to avoid all three panelists answering every single question because then we don't get enough done. So we'll start here. Okay, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Li Yang. About urbanization, I think there are several, and I will try to limit three related issues. First, is whether they want to develop based on a public-private partnership, which very often, whether in the United States or in Africa, they usually is misused and abused. And second, related to this monetary of government policies, how do they really treat the rural area, the land ownership? How do they really take away their land values? They maybe say your land originally is somewhat 100% market value, but then they reduce to, let's say, about 50% by some manipulations. And the third one is about hukou registration. The way you do this, whether there's an intrusion of private privacy or they have some kind of threat or some kind of the way they want to enforce their policies, or they will take the opponents prisoners, political prisoners. So how do you deal with that issues?
Okay. I'll keep track. And the gentleman back there.
Yeah, Bill Jones from Executive Intelligence Review. In connection with the new normal, the Chinese government, of course, has issued the One Belt, One Road policy which will be the focal point, one of the developing points of the economy. I'm wondering, as this thing grows, it seems to me that the second and third tier cities will become more important because they will be placed on a main corridor of economic development between Europe and Asia. And I was wondering, how do you see that affecting the urbanization process as a whole? It seems to me that there will be an acceleration and will provide more opportunities, but I'd like your opinion on that.
Okay, good question. And I'm going to call my colleague Ken Liebertal, but there will be plenty of time to get it to everybody who's got their hands up.
Thank you. Very, very interesting panel. I have three questions, if I can, but they're generally very short answers required. One, when you talk about the plans for urbanization in the next 5 to 10 years, how much the urban population will grow, a little bit of a definitional question. As current migrants in the cities who still have rural hukou obtain urban hukou, does that count as urbanization? In other words, do they count as the increase in urban residents, or is it only people literally moving into the cities that are envisioned when you talk about the additional number, you know, the additional rate of urbanization? So that's number one. In other words, there's a definition. Are you talking about ongoing immigration, or are you also counting simply the changing hukou of people already there? Secondly, a lot of current urban migrants have parents and kids in the countryside. To what extent is the next stage of urbanization envisaging not only bringing the kids into the cities, but bringing the parents into the cities? So as completion of families, that will have a lot of repercussions for the requirements for provision of public goods and also for employment and productivity. And then finally, the discussion has really been in terms of migration to second and third tier cities versus to the largest cities. But China faces enormous differences in the capacity to sustain urban growth in terms of things like available, usable water supplies. And I haven't seen urbanization plans differentiated in terms of the resource base, especially for water. And so my question is that being factored in? And if so, how does that affect the comments that you've made? Thank you.
Ken, can you give the mic to the gentleman next to you, and you'll start the next round if you just hold the mic, okay? So if you just – I'm trying to be efficient. So okay. What we're going to do is we're going to go down this way, and then the next round we'll come back. Okay. You know, so you pick out what
you
want.
Pick up the questions and one. Okay,
and I'll
good.
Take anything left over I have to answer.
Thank
okay?
you. Thank you. I point, just pick one of the questions. You asked three questions. One question regarding to PPP, private-public partnership. So mechanism in the process of urbanization, we ignored it in this kind of a mechanism before because all the infrastructures building by the government finance. So, and also the whole urbanization pushing forward, based on the finance from the government before. This is the old model, but now Premier Li Keqiang very clearly, especially the Vice Minister Liu Jiwei, last year mentioned very clearly we need to use the PPP model mechanism to promote urbanization from now on, the second round urbanization, which is what called the new urbanization, right? So that means more and more investment opportunities in the cities, like infrastructure facilities, subways, transportation system can be done by the private people, your private investors, usually done by the government companies, right? So now I think this is a good sign. Now already started from last year. So this is a lot of problem from now on. Your question, one belt, one road, So I think that would be very, very good, very positive, very positive for developing the western part of China, particularly five, underdeveloped provinces, Shaanxi, Gansu, Ningxia, Xinjiang, and Qinghai, right? So along with the increase, I think a significant increase of transportation capacity and the people's, the flow of our commodities, merchants, and also flow of people among different countries in the western part of China, by linking with China and Europe. So that would be very, very positive to your support the overall development of the whole western part of China. We spent, as you know, that we spent almost 20 years, 50 years to develop the western, you know, part of China. But, you know, not efficient, you know, if results come out so far. I think this round of the strategy, as you mentioned, that one belt, one road policy will be absolutely, you know, to increase will be positive for the development of this region. And the final question is, Mr. Nika, by the way, I read your book, Governing China. Thank you very much. The question you just mentioned that, what's the question?
Maybe we should,
I'm
guessing Huasheng is still working, and there's some good questions for Li Guo, yeah.
Okay. I directly go to his question about whether to change the registration of rural hukou to urban hukou is mean something, subsistence. I think it's, answer is affirmative. Yeah, why the local government don't want to give a local urban hukou to the migrant workers? The migrant workers including not only the people from countryside, but also from the other small towns or cities, you see. And the reason is if you give them the urban hukou, you obliged to provide all these benefits, including the most important thing is low cost housing. That's very costly. So that's why they cannot provide local hukou to the migrant workers, not only for the agricultural worker, but also from other migrant citizens from small city or towns or middle-sized city towns. Yeah, so that's why we have so strict control in the big city like Beijing, Shanghai. Yeah, but take it carefully from now on, because the central government began to stress the importance of urbanization. Then local governments began to learn a new way to deal with it. Recent report is some local government simply change the rural residence hukou into an urban hukou. And nothing else changed. They all stay in the village. And how can they retain their land? The way is every family change 1 to 2 person into an urban hukou. So later on, if you find the urban hukou in terms of urbanization rate increase very quickly, you have to think it all again. Yeah. So that is a TV interview, TV report on the Chinese central CCTV. Yeah. So I think, to answer the question, local hukou is very, very important, the local urban hukou, because that is an instrument to discriminate the people other than the local urban residents. Yeah, without this, you cannot discriminate people. Yeah. And I think the Chinese government began to make efforts to encourage people to the small, as you mentioned, the third and the fourth tier cities. I will think this effort will be fair. Yeah, because we can see all these migrant workers, they choose the cities or towns or place to go driven by market force. Yeah, they calculate very carefully. Yes. And usually they will go with a family or even with the whole village of the residents. Come to Shanghai or some places. Okay. So the thing is, for Chinese government, I think, what you mentioned is important, the water and the environmental sustainability. So they should take this into consideration and to select certain middle-sized or even big cities with water and environmental condition to develop. So that means we have to shift the focus of investment from the inner, the core area of the big city, like let's say Beijing, within the four rings, and to find the other, to set up other local centers around the Beijing with plenty of water supply or the other resources. So I think you cannot prevent people to move in into big cities and also the east, the coast area. We can see from the other countries. Yeah, the reason is very simple, because you can find a job with good income and attraction there, rather than in the small city and the towns. I believe many villages and many small cities and towns will be deserted during the process of urbanization. So if you put too much money into these places, that will be a big waste.
You have 10 seconds.
10 seconds.
10 seconds. Because he's the carries question back to my mind. Okay, just 10 seconds. Okay. The new plan, urbanization plan issued by the government last year, exactly 1 year ago, focus very much in the first time the, you know, how to improve the building up stronger, strengthen the capacity of sustainable development of cities, which includes more efficient use of resources, smart city, you know, these kind of things, right? So the providing more job opportunities for the people. So resource management included into the new plan. This is good news for you and also for all of us. Thank you.
Li Gua, there was a question about, you know, rural land values, and you may want to comment on water and any of these other issues. Okay.
Very good. I'm very happy. Basically, no question left for me to answer. But back to that land taking compensation. Exactly. I think that's the reason why government now is push forward the land, the land taking, land acquisition reform. The background, actually, I know this topic a little bit more, you know. Based on China's constitution, urban land belongs to state. Rural land belongs to village collectives. Then, so, which sounds very clear. However, the problem lies in this simple sentence. Because urban land, the urban boundary is changing, ever changing. So, by this sentence, which means whenever, you know, the urban land expanded to which area, then that land has to be taken by government. But, because by land management law, the land taken by government calculates the compensation calculated based on the agricultural output. The agricultural output is times 30 years, so that's your compensation. That's very, very low, particularly in, you know, suburban area. That's with the potential for urban use. There's no way you can keep their living standard. So the government recognizes that. That's a big source of social unrest. So you have to reform the land acquisition. And they are piloting different ways, borrow lessons from Taiwan, from Japan, from Korea, and also try to, you know, be innovative. And then I think it has an implication on, as you can see, on constitution. It's a very challenging topic. Back to that definition of the urbanization. Yes, if you look at the China Statistics Bureau yearbook, basically they publish urbanization in two categories. One is by residence, another one where you live, another one is by hukou. Everybody knows if you just change hukou without giving associated benefits, it's meaningless. So that's the reason why I say, you know, that's one of the challenges. It's not just a piece of a paper issue. You know, just give a new book, a registration book. Actually, you have to come with that book, some meaningful benefits. So that involves huge negotiation and compromise. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's take another round.
Madam, correct me. Okay. Yeah. About land reform in the suburb of big cities. I think, yeah, according to the old regulation, you compensate the farmers with, according to the agricultural products, around 2-30 years. It seems very low. Yes, that's right. Especially in remote area when the government construct a big project. The compensation is very low indeed. But surrounding the big cities or the cities which is very hot in terms of housing market, the compensation has increased very quickly and it's sky high. You can hear many people in the suburb that become very rich because they get compensation, let's say, the 10 horse for compensation. And in China, even you get, let's say, 10 or 20 million of Chinese yuan for compensation, you needn't to pay one single cent of money for tax. Yeah. So that's why the Chinese government has involved in very deep trouble in terms of high debt. And that's part of the reason. So I think talk about the lending reform, we have to be carefully to distinguish the farmer in the small town, surrounding small towns and remote area, and from the farmer surrounding the big cities. Okay.
Thank you very much. Okay, so I gave you the mic.
Sandy Apgar, Urban Lands Institute. I must say, from some years of being in Brookings conferences, this is the longest I have ever held a mic. two-part question. First, with the enormous scale of your first-tier cities, have you found diseconomies, inefficiencies in the scale itself? Has it measured? What scope is there? And secondly, with your comparisons, which several of you have mentioned, have you compared China's first-tier cities with other urban agglomerations? Mexico City comes to mind, which have grown very rapidly and with certain similarities, though many differences. Thank you.
So I'm going to take three, and I already said when we answer, we're going to go in the other direction. So I know, Li Guo, okay. You're going to have something to say about the first. I feel like I need to go to the very way in the back to that gentleman who's got his hand up very high because I don't want to discriminate against the back. Can we get a microphone back there?
Thank you, Sheng Yang from China Daily. Two questions to Mr. Hu Biliang. The first one is from policy angle. How do you see that there are some voices in China calling in China calling for de-urbanization. Mm-hmm. For example, in Bishan Village, Anhui Province, there is a de-urbanization project, I think. And do you think that the urbanization is inevitable trend in China? And the second question is on the personal angle. How do you think that people can, for example, migrant workers can overcome their identification recognition crisis in this urbanization trend? Mm-hmm. And another question to Dr. Caesars. What do you think that China can learn from Americans' urbanization process? Thank you.
I already sent the mic over there.
I'm Julia Chang Block, president of the U.S.-China Education Trust. I have a very quick follow-up question to David, your question to Ding Hu, about whether people are actually moving into the third and fourth tier cities. I'd like to throw in second-tier cities as well, because I read recently online, I'm sorry, I can't remember the citation, but there is a new trend, I think a year or two old, where the graduates of Juyaoyao universities, like Tsinghua, are actually not opting to stay in Beijing or go to coastal cities, but they are actually opting to go and move into second tier, and perhaps not fourth tier, but second or third tier cities. And the article was very vague about why, but they cited better opportunities in terms of jobs and, of course, the pollution in Beijing. So I want to ask, given the discussions we've had this morning, is this information correct? And if it is correct, what are the specific causes of this kind of a movement, because I never heard of that before. And in addition, I wonder whether this indicates that the Chinese urbanites are beginning to perhaps find their living conditions in the first tier cities not to be so attractive. Is this a general trend, or is this a very limited?
Can you hand the mic right in front of you to my boss, Lee Chung? We'll take one more in this round, okay?
Oh, dear boss. Well, first, it's 211, not 911. Yeah, 211. Yeah.
No, 918. 211, 2-1-1, two different concepts.
211,
yeah.
Well, excellent panel discussion, and like David, I learned a great deal. Now, I have three questions for panelists. The first of all, two deans, that if I understand correct, there's a serious debate in China in terms of strategy of urbanization, whether emphasize what the Premier Li called 城镇化, in a small township or small city, or this is really driven by market, maybe eventually will be go to large city. Do you see there's a serious debate in the leadership? And this is the first question. The second question is related with the sequence of the reform. And both of you talk about these reforms so interconnected. And thank you, Dean Huasen, to correct my mistake, that you are absolutely right, that it's not so much about speed, but rather scale and scope probably is quite remarkable. And thank you, I will use your interpretation in the future. And so the sequence in your suggestion for the leadership, it seemed like that, correct me if my observation is incorrect, that urbanization is continuing, but it's not the top priority at the moment. Maybe the financial reform, maybe private sector development, service sector development is a priority, along with the anti-corruption and et cetera. Now, another question for Li Guo, that in terms of the agriculture development, there's argument with China's GDP in the growth slow down, and many people believe that the structure will profoundly change. There's an argument that the agriculture products probably will, or rural development will be the emphasis, whether you're willing or not willing. So therefore, you see a lot of companies like previously engaged in like real estate now start to do agriculture products. Do you see that's a trend happening in China? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So as I said, we'll start with Li Guo and come this way on this round.
Okay, great. Many questions is addressed to them, so I'm very happy about that. Let me just respond by my observation, from rural development perspective. I just, about 3 months ago, I visited Guangxi province, very remote, poor, one of the national designated poor counties. I observed their urbanization process in that county. About, say, for those young farmers born after 1980 or in 1990s, the younger generation, basically they don't have any farming experience and there are no way they will go back to their hometown. And about 30% of them actually bought a house in the countryside and they bring the whole families with them. I have to say I'm quite optimistic because I didn't see the tension between the existing, countryside residents and these newcomers because they bought a house and they provide services. And also in terms of education, everybody expects, they may compete for education resources. However, because in urban area, the population growth decline. Actually, these new kids from rural area, the school capacity has been there, so they can accommodate more kids. So it's not that severe in terms of, the tension. I don't know whether I answer any question or not, but that's my observations I offer that. So I think that's also the market force driven. Nobody is asking them, you can only move to this. You can also, of course, go to Shanghai, go to Guangzhou, but they choose to. I think they have their own calculation.
What about the first question on whether there are diseconomies from Chinese cities becoming too big and congested?
Oh, yeah. The comparison, the Mexico City and Beijing, whether, I'm not an urban specialist. I'm really proud for me too. To answer that question, I leave to them. Thank you.
Huasheng?
Yeah, I think take the urbanization as a whole. Yeah, if we overlook it, okay. I think the main things China now are facing is very low real urbanization rate. compared to the China's economy at this stage. That is the big judgment. Yeah. Of course, the rural life is attractive and so on and so forth. Yeah, all these things you're talking, especially in the developed world. But the main thing is China, with only 36 or 37% of urban population, they are a real urban population. What I mean is they have the living style, the consumption tendency is like urban citizens rather than the rural residents. But for majority of the agricultural migrants, although they work in the city, but their living style and their living conditions is more close to the farmer in the village. So that's why China shock off the demand and in terms of service industry, because all these people living in the city, but they spend their money in the countryside. And they build a house in their hometown, but they never come back, only once a year. Also, many people, many migrant workers, when they have enough money, they buy a house in their county town. Yeah. They think it's better than they set up, they built a house in the village. Yeah, it's a progress, but it's still, it looks to me, is a great waste of resources. Because they worked in the East Coast. They worked in the big and middle-sized city, but they buy a house in the county town. It's meaningless. So they expect they will return to their home county when they are old. So there's a lot of misinvestment in China at the moment. So that's this real challenge things. And about the people in the big city, of course, the city scale become extremely large, then there is this economy. Yeah, that's true. So I think the choice is not by us. It's by the people, by all these migrants. Okay, so I think the good idea is to set up more satellite cities surrounding the big city or in the East Coast area, because you cannot drive people away from there. Yeah, they find a job there. They feel that's good for them. So that's why I come. Okay. And so I think the challenge is how to redirect the investment from the big city to all these satellite cities or second tier cities. It's not only concerned with the economy, but also concerned with the politics. Yeah. For example, the famous university in US, yeah, we can find in all these small or middle-sized towns and cities, but in China, all crowded in the big cities. But it's extremely difficult for them to move out. If you ask all the teachers, fellows in the university, no one wants to move out. Yeah. And they will ask why the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party move out first, so on and so forth. Okay. So it's very difficult. Yeah. So now the main challenge lies here. Yeah, I think the Hukou reform, there's some similarity like the illegal immigrant in America. Yeah, there's some similarity here. Yeah, I think the most important thing is money. Yeah, the cities want their labor, like America. They need immigrant labor. But the thing is, if you provide the equal living standards to all these migrants, that means you have to pull down the living standard of the urban residents, especially in the big cities. That has a political implication. Okay, that's my challenge. Yeah. And so I can see the difficulty here. In terms of debate, yeah.
actually, the serious debate in China within the government, within the party, is not the hukou reform. No one against. No one against the hukou reform. Yeah, hukou reform, yeah. We will go step by step. We cannot lift out overnight. Just like in US, you can't lift the control of illegal immigrant overnight. Okay. I think the fierce debate is on the land reform. Because the land reform is the key of the interest, the financial resource. Yeah. How to allocate the land revenue, the land value. That's the most important thing. That's concerned with the hukou reform. Because how is the money come from? And it concerned with the fiscal reform. How to finance? How can local governments can accommodate all these migrants? In the meantime, they still provide infrastructure without increase of the mounting debt. So that's a real challenge. So many things discussed in the West or in the Chinese newspaper is not a real challenge. Real challenge is all these delicate and subtle issues. So the debate, especially around the third plenary meeting of 18th Congress, is on this issue. Yeah, the communique of third plenary meeting of 18th Congress, approved by Western commentators and also in China academic circle. Yeah. But the thing is, what they promised in the communique is not implementable. Yeah. So that's why there are so many corrections. Yeah. So before that, there is a serious debate within the government. Yeah. I'm firmly against what written on the communique. I said that's not implementable. It's not, you cannot implement it. Yeah. You promise something, but you cannot do it. Then you will create more confusion. So that's why after the meeting, there are so many high officials come out and says, yeah, that's not our meaning. That's not our indication, and so on and so forth. That's why. So we cannot judge all these slogans, all these reform measures by on the paper. You have to look into the Chinese context. What kind of mechanism can really work? Okay, I'll stop here.
Li Guo wanted to come in very briefly.
Yes, because I forgot to answer the question from your boss.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. In terms of a sequence, personally, I think the very important one is housing. Second is education. Other medical insurance, pension, I think because the private sector can step in, I think the degree in terms of urgency is not that, no comparison. Then back to another question, now, whether you see there is a trend, the capitals move to urban area, move to a rural area to buy farms, to put, buy land from farmers.
To
farming, to some commercial farming. Actually, that's a trend. I already observed that. And I come from Chengdu, my hometown. I saw a lot of friends, my friends, classmates. Now they bought 300, 400 mu farmland to do farming. And they hire back these villagers to do some job, pay their salary. Looks like both sides are quite happy. It's a 10-year contract, 15-year contract. Each every year, they convert. Their compensation is 750 kilograms rice then times the price at that moment. So that's compensation. Looks like both sides are quite happy. Thank you.
So because of the...
you go ahead.
Because of the limitation of the time, I try to answer your question. One sentence for one question. But because of all the questions, I find a very, very good question. So I like all the questions. So I try to answer all the questions. One question, one sentence. Two questions proposed by Li Cheng. I think very, very good questions. Why, what's the difference between Chen Zhenghua and Chen Shihua? I think my understanding is the rural-urban integration. So this is the focus of Chen Zhenghua. Focus on integration. Because, you know, we are dual system in China. It's a long time we try to integrate it to rural development and urban development. So this is the essence of the concept of 城镇化 compared with 城市化, which, you know, before more focus, more, maybe only focus on city development, right? The second question you proposed, why, you know, the urbanization is no longer, maybe it's not that clear, the priority now than before. I think a simple answer to your question is, you know, is new normal. Because new normal, you know, so changed idea, so changed mentality. So the growth is not no longer the most, you know, the priority for the top leaders, right? But improve the quantity no longer with the quantity, right? These are the 2 points relating to your question. Relating to your question, economy and this economy. My answer to the question is that in the initial stage of the development, this is very much relating to your 2 factors. One is the stage of urbanization. The second is the structure of the cities of the urban, in the urban area. In the initial stage of the development, normally industrialization before urbanization, in this period of time, you know, urbanization, they are very supportive to industrialization, you know, which we will see more positive impact, which is economy, urbanization economy, rather than this economy. And also another, you know, situation is along with the improve of the improve of the structure. So from the industry development to the service dominated economy, and then we will see more economy rather this economy, right? The scale, all optimum scale of the cities is a long time debate issue. There's so far there's no, you know, firm answer to this question. So I just try to give 2 factors. You know, when you think about this kind of issue, of course, I don't have a, you know, firm answer to your question as well. And the, you know, my answer to your question, you know, whether urbanization, you know, show some new trends in the future. I think I put your questions with the, my friend from China Daily questions together. So, NIST will not see de-urbanization. It's not a good idea to de-urbanization at this stage, especially for a big developed country like in China. It's a very stupid way to do that. But in the future, maybe it will be changed because of the cyberspace development, ICT development, you know, show a different way of, you know, better life, you know, in rural areas or rather in very concentrated in the cities, right? So this is a very possible view to kind of the situation. Now if they're in Western Europe, right, this is maybe linked with the question from, you know, by David Dowler. When then more from, you know, urbanization, I mean, then much more from US rather than Western Europe. So we need to also get a balance and then a little bit from Western Europe, and then the pattern of urbanization will be different. So that's I pass to David, and he's going to talk about that, okay, because he's American, okay? Thank you.
Yeah, so there was a question about, you know, what China can learn from the U.S. So my first reaction to that was in the area of urbanization, you're better off learning from the Europeans. You know, the Europeans tend to have environmentally friendly, well-managed, concentrated cities. The United States often has a lot of sprawl and an automobile-based society, and it's debatable whether that works for the United States, but I'm pretty sure that's not going to work for China, frankly. So I would definitely look at some of the European examples. But then from the point of the United States, I would say one of the important lessons is the U.S. has always had very, very good labor mobility. You know, it is easy for people to pick up and move, and they can show up the day or two before school starts and get your kids into school. You know, it's really not a problem. But actually in the U.S., labor mobility has declined in recent years. And many economists think this is a reason why the U.S. economy is not performing so well, partly related to so many people being underwater on their mortgages in the housing market. So it's hard to move if you can't sell your house. And then also more and more states are having licenses and regulations for different occupations. So this is, you know, if you're a hairdresser in one part of the United States, there's a slight disincentive to moving to other parts because of this trend toward licensing more occupations, which doesn't seem like a healthy development. So I would say learn the lesson there. Make it easy for people to move around. That has big productivity advantages. We have time, I rule, for 2 more questions from the back, the very gentleman at the very back. That seems fair. And then this gentleman here, the one that's closest to me, yeah. And then I think we're going to, I predict we're going to have to wrap up, yeah.
Nick Eberstadt from American Enterprise Institute. Thank you for this fascinating discussion. My question is about migration and urban labor markets. Is there any information on the wage differentials today between migrants and non-migrants in the cities? To what extent can this be explained by educations and skills as opposed to, let's say, discrimination? And is there any information over time on how those trends have changed?
Okay, excellent question. And then
thank you very much for your very interesting conversation. I'm Takahiro Motegi from CSS Japan Chair. I'd like to ask you about the election. Now, it's probably the election level. I mean, now it's very limited. There is a very limitation. So, I'm sorry, is now the level of election is limited at the Zhongranghua village level. So what I want to ask you is, what kind of impression the urbanization give this kind of limit? Thank you very much.
Okay, I think we maybe have time for one more. So the gentleman who had his hand up right there with the blue shirt. This will be, by the way, your final comments, okay? So, yep.
Thank you very much. My name is Kumar. I'm an independent consultant in the energy sector. I'd just like to draw some parallel with the experience that we have in India. When Indian new government actually took place and they started their program on developing smart cities, satellite cities around the major metropolitan cities, the one of the major problems that they faced was the land acquisition. And today itself, the parliament session is going on. There's a strong farmers' agitation which is going on in the country. And one of the major criticisms that is being faced by the government is that doesn't matter what amount of compensation that you give to farmers today, whether it's one time or two times the market rate, farmers are not financial savvy. This money is going to go away one day. And the major criticism is that you are basically, by taking away their land, you're basically depriving the farmers from their traditional vocation as well as the regular income that they were having from their agriculture produce. Now, one of the possible solutions that the government has come up with is that government will provide pensions to the farmers and probably one job per family in that particular area. I wanted to know how the Chinese government is tackling this particular problem. Thank you very much.
Okay. Huasheng, why don't we start with you? Because I've always been starting at the ends, and that doesn't seem fair. This is your last chance to comment, address any of these questions, okay. And any final brief remarks.
Yeah. Yeah, I answer the first question about the discrimination in terms of salary of migrant workers and with local urban citizens. I think there's no difference at all. There's no discrimination at all, according to my knowledge. But there is a difference here. The thing is, the migrant workers, especially agricultural workers, consist of the bulk of the blue-collar workforce. So they can earn the same salary as the urban residents, as a blue-collar worker. But very few of them, because lack of the human capital, can employ it in the high-pay sectors. So that's not some discrimination from the regulations. Yeah, as a matter of fact, let's say the a woman working in Beijing for a family as a babysitter and look after the home affairs earn more than their county secretary in their home county, the official income. Yeah, it's much higher than that, yeah, according to official income. So I think the problem is, the thing is actually China has the freest labor market in the world, I think. Yeah, the people can move to anywhere to find a job and offered by employee. When employee offer the jobs, so they do not care about whether they are local residents or not, except for some government sector. But now majority of employment post offered by the private sector, joint venture sector. So it doesn't matter, actually. Influence very little. But main thing is because of the lack of home education. And the seldom can enter the high-paid industry. Okay.
Okay. Li Guo?
Okay, yeah, very quick. Yeah, so in terms of wage difference, I also didn't, you know, personal knowledge is I don't observe that. And of course, they engage into different sectors. There was different sector wage difference. That's another question. In terms of election, yes, I would imagine, you know, the urban fabrics, you know, in after 10 or 20 years will change, and they will have a implication on governance system, you know. So now the urban rural election is very popular. And you elect Chun Zhang, Chun Suji, Chun Zhang, Chun Zhuren. But I think in future, that will, that kind of a tradition will, in city will also be changed. What's the last one? The financial saving in India. Yeah, well, what, the practice in China is, yeah, you give a farmer's compensation. Of course, you also has a, how to say, requirements. So 1/3 will give you cash. 1/3 will save as your pension. Another 1/3 will pay some other medical service to buy other insurance. I think that's a sort of a practice instead of just a lump sum cash give to you, then is at your disposal completely. No, it's not that case.
Can I weigh in on that and then give you the last word? Because I don't want to have the last word. But, you know, the World Bank has done a lot of infrastructure projects in China. They often involve resettlement. And, you know, the World Bank has its own complicated resettlement policies. But when I visited projects, I always wanted to meet people who'd been resettled. And when I was in Hangzhou, you know, we met people who'd been resettled. They'd been given an apartment in a really, you know, really lovely apartment complex. So I met this old man in the park, you know, outside. And, you know, I talked to him about the resettlement process and all that. And then all of a sudden he said that he had to head home for lunch. And he got up and he started walking away from the apartment. And I said, wait a minute, don't you live here? And he said, no, I own an apartment here. But I rent it out, you know, and I bought a little house, you know, a couple of miles down the road. But he comes every day, you know, and he hangs out in the park there. So our experience at the local level, you know, often the resettlement process, certainly there was negotiation involved. Sorry, not in our projects, but in the kind of ones financed just by the government. There's negotiation. I agree with Dean Hua that the compensation has risen a lot over time, but it's often an interesting package of an urban hukou, an apartment, and perhaps some money, which kind of addresses to some extent the issue of what happens if you just give people a lot of money and they may not know how to earn an income stream. And now we're going to give you the last word, okay?
Okay, thank you. Again, just a very quick, briefly directed to the question. I think the professor friend, you know, you ask a question, but and also at the same time he answered the question by himself. Because, you know, there are some differences there. Not the discrimination, but because of the less educated, right? And also some certain accident, but also discrimination there. For the rural people, migrants, they, in most of the cities, in many cities, and this is, you know, some of the cities, if not most of them, you know, for example, like in Beijing, the migrant workers, they are not allowed to work in some of the sectors. So this is the institutional constraint. So, less educated, institutional constraint make the salaries is different between rural residents and, you know, migrants from rural areas. Okay? The question by a Japanese friend, if I'm, you're correct. I think based on the current urbanization model, there's no, you know, no impact from each other. So that means the urbanization will not give the impact to our village governance or village inaction, good or bad. There's no. But if the government of China try to, you know, to push forward a kind of a new way of urbanization, as I just mentioned to your to the question, you know, to integrate rural and urban development, that kind of a new urbanization will give a positive impact to, you know, village election. So I think, this is my brief answer to your question. And the final question, I think, David gave a very good answer to the question, so I just try to save some time. I don't want, no need for me to answer the question. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you very much. So I think we've had a really great discussion of a fascinating and fluid topic in China. You know, I find it encouraging just that there's so much debate among intellectuals, but of course also among the policymakers and among ordinary people and the media about all these difficult issues. They're not simple issues, but clearly there's going to be a continuing trend toward urbanization. There's going to be hukou reform. It's going to be fascinating to watch how it plays out over the next 10, 20 years. So thank you very much for your participation. Let's give the group a big hand.